From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, those open lines. And then a special tribute to the late Rosemary Ellen Guiley. Here's what's happening. My, oh my, what is Vladimir Putin of Russia up to? The U.S. Air Force is seeing the highest activity of Russian aircraft over Alaska since the Cold War, according to a top U.S. commander. The increased military activity in the area is attributed to Russia's expanding activities, according to Air Force generals. But what are they up to? President Biden has not ruled out requiring military personnel to get a COVID-19 vaccine, saying it's a tough call. The president said that when it comes to the military, he will leave it to the armed forces to decide, but that he has not ruled out requiring the vaccine. I know when I was in the Navy, they required many types of vaccines that we were required to get. Malaria shots and everything else. 100 million people in the United States have been fully vaccinated so far against the coronavirus, according to the White House. And about 55% of all U.S. adults have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. Swarm of earthquakes, 3 over magnitude 5, striking off the Oregon coast. What the heck does this all mean? Let's check in with expert on earthquakes, Cal Ori. Cal, what's this mean, these little swarms?
You always throw me. Well, I was going to talk about the Japan quake that just happened tonight. I'm aware of the Oregon quakes. I'm not worried about them, though. I never have been to Oregon. If it was off the coast of British Columbia, yes, the Cascadia subduction zone. But no.
So nothing to worry about that. What about Japan?
6.8 and 6.62.
Oh, that's pretty good size.
Huh?
That's good size.
Yeah, well, the problem is it hit right where it hit on the quake tsunami that I predicted back in March 11th, 2011. And I do believe in history repeats itself. Now, I just read that they're warning more aftershocks are going to happen within a week.
And oh, boy.
Could create landslides. But you know, with that Iceland volcano, and I told you that everybody was playing it down and then it blew, I have a feeling, I'm going to go ahead and predict it, there's going to be a stronger quake in Japan within, I'll give it a 2-week window, probably sooner though. And, you know, the infrastructure there, what are they going to do? It's so crowded.
Oh, yeah, everybody's packed together out there.
Exactly. So they're not going to evacuate. That's just not going to happen. And they probably won't have any warning anyway, not really.
Now, the earthquake that hit Fukushima was an 8.9. Cal, that's big, right?
Yeah, that's a great quake. And look at the tsunami. 16,000 people drowned from that tsunami, I just read, and probably more than that. That was horrific. Just horrific. I'll never forget that. I'm not predicting a great quake, but I am predicting at least a major, which is a 7.0 to an 8.0. It's been quiet. I mean, well, in March they had a 7.2. So
quiet. Quiet's not good.
I'm sorry?
Quiet's not good.
Well, I'm not getting what you're saying. Why is it?
Because that means something's building up.
Yeah, that's what I'm telling you. And when I do my annual forecast in December, I looked at Japan, and I got a weird vibe, and I should have went with it, but I went with New Zealand, which I was right, where they did have the quake tsunami, but it was just small waves recently. But for some reason, I just, you know, I thought, and then I just dismissed it. But I don't have a good feeling about it, definitely.
Go with your gut instincts, Cal. Thank you so much. Well, it's a familiar question from your healthcare provider. Are you getting enough sleep? Studies have shown that adequate sleep, now that's between 7 and 9 hours a day for adults, can improve cognition, mood, immune functioning. But new research reveals that it's not just the hours sleep that count toward mental health benefits. It's whether the sleep occurs on a regular or irregular schedule. Of course, if you sleep the way we all do, listening to this late show, we don't get much sleep, do we? America is running low on chicken, and you can blame COVID-19, a sandwich craze, and huge appetite for chicken wings. That's true, but it's really happening. All around the country, there is beginning to become a shortage of chicken. Scientists have spotted yet another bizarre, gigantic, and unexplained circle-shaped radio structure in outer space, a discovery that contributes to exciting times in astronomy, according to a new study. The bubble is the latest example of what they call an odd radio cycle, named a type of ring that debuted in a 2020 paper by Western Sydney University astrophysicist Ray Norris. His colleagues detected four of these enormous circles, eerily glowing in faint radio wavelengths far beyond our galaxy. What else is going on in the skies these days? Let's check in with Kevin Randall and his UFO report. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, George. How's it going?
Okay.
Yeah, here's a strange one for you. Over the last weekend, someone in one of the NICAP groups mentioned that he hadn't found any documentation supporting the existence of Project Moondust. I responded with a couple of documents suggesting I'd found the comment bizarre. Brad Sparks pointed out that my examples didn't say Project Moondust, merely Moondust. The thinking is that Moondust was an identifier attached to documentation about UFOs and the recovery of returning space debris. It wasn't a project in the sense that it had a headquarters and a staff assigned to it. When the Air Force said there had not been a Project Moondust, it might be that they were technically correct. It boils down to that Moondust might have been a code word for the real project that was tasked with the recovery operations. When Robert Todd was told that Moondust no longer existed and was replaced by something new that was properly classified, it might have meant that the code word had been changed. I have an in-depth analysis of this at my blog for those who want more information at www.kevinrandall.blogspot.com.
Okay, good.
Now, looking at some of the recent sightings, I'll note that those who visit there, meaning my blog, and who have listened to my reports here, know that I have talked about triangular-shaped craft being reported much more frequently. That trend continues. Early in the morning of April 23rd, a witness in Firestone, Colorado, saw a chevron-shaped craft moving silent across the sky. It flew slowly, moving west to east in a straight line. It had seven lights that had no color, and it did not change speed. It was in sight for about 10 seconds. On April 22nd, a retired sergeant from the sheriff's department, now living in Appleton, Wisconsin, saw a triangular-shaped object overhead. He said that it appeared to be tumbling, though it didn't move. It was silent. He ran inside to get his cell phone, but the picture he got wasn't very good. You can see the shape of the object and the tumbling motion. The object was silent. About 20 minutes later, he returned to the house, and the object was still in the sky. On April 22nd, a witness in India with his brother saw a boomerang-shaped object moving at great speed, flew behind a tree, reappeared losing altitude, and moving toward the witnesses. There were two brownish boomerang shapes facing each other with several lights of red, yellow, brown, and green. The UFO flew overhead and seemed to be releasing some of those lights. It began to move in a circular motion, and all the lights detached, moving in various directions and then disappearing. On April 21st, witnesses in Woolbridge, New Jersey, reported a UFO. It was described as a strange, unrecognizable aircraft with bright lights. The interesting thing here is that they said when they spotted the UFO, their lights flickered and their cell phones stopped working. This is an example of a UFO interacting with the environment. And finally, my book, UFOs in the Deep State, drops tomorrow, or depending where you are, it's already dropped. This is something a little different for me, and I think it answers some of the questions about UFOs that have been asked for years but have not been satisfactorily explained. And that's it for today, George.
All right, Kevin, we'll talk to you next week. Thank you very much, Kevin Randall. His website, again, is kevinrandall.blogspot.com. Well, COVID was devastating to Las Vegas, but things are picking up again. As a matter of fact, they're saying Las Vegas attendance is really, really picking up. In a moment, we're going to talk with Bill Friedman, author of a number of books, including 30 Illegal Years to the Strip, talking about Las Vegas, of course. We're going to talk with him about what's going on in Las Vegas, how did the mob get involved in it, and what's the latest on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me introduce Bill Friedman. He was last with me about 5 years ago. Bill has spent his career in the casino business. He taught the Pioneer Course in Casino Management at the College of Hotel Administration, UNLV. He turned two longtime losing casinos on the Las Vegas Strip into top profit makers. He's consulted to casinos all over this planet. He's got a number of books, including Casino Management, all against the law, 30 illegal years to the strip. And wait till you hear what we're going to talk about tonight. If you've ever been to Las Vegas, this is going to be a fun couple hours for you. If you've never been to Las Vegas, you're going to be fascinated with this too. Bill, welcome back.
It's great to be here.
I'm looking forward to this. So COVID, how devastating was COVID to the casino business?
It basically shut it down for a long period of time. And as was mentioned earlier, it's recovering now, but nothing like this has ever happened in my lifetime. So it's not like I can mention anything about a pattern. We just have to wait day to day to see what happens.
Absolutely. Las Vegas, of course, has lived and died with convention business, and that is just about plummeted, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's, the people aren't getting together. They are starting to plan to have conventions again within the next few months, and they're putting everything together to make them work in a safe manner.
Somebody just won $2.9 million at the slots at the Venetian. Do they know when that's going to kick?
No, it's all computerized, and the computer makes the decisions every time that you put the coins in.
So let's talk a little bit about Vegas, of course. We had an intern working for us years ago called Will Wilkerson. His father, of course, was the son of Willie Wilkerson, Bill Wilkerson, who was starting the Flamingo that Buzzy Siegel and the boys bought out. And that's, I guess, how things started there, huh?
Well, two places opened on the Strip at the beginning of World War II. And that's a fascinating thing to me because they were really an adjunct to the military. They built the world's biggest Air Force base in Las Vegas because it has so much sunshine year-round.
Sure.
And they needed extra rooms, so these two hotels opened, but there was no tourism at that time. They were basically set there for the officers and for the businessmen, and they had a contract, they had prices set, and those were the first two places. Then after the war, Siegel opened the Flamingo and started the movement of where it would go. He had a dream for the Strip, and he was one of the top bootleggers in America, highly respected by all the major gang leaders, and he had this incredible vision. He preached it. He was going about to build a golf course. Everything that the Strip became, he foresaw, and when he was killed, all of these former friends of his that had profits out of the Prohibition built his dream. And it was really his design of where this town went.
Truly a visionary. When he saw this happening, he got all excited, didn't he?
Well, he saw a tremendous potential as it would become. But what he didn't foresee, because he was the most popular dinner guest in Hollywood, all of the big stars, all of the producers, the top businessmen in Beverly Hills wanted him for dinner. And they all loved him, and he thought they'd pour in. Well, he made a miscalculation because there were some outstanding illegal casinos in Southern California, and they didn't need to come to Vegas. And it was after the Kefauver Committee, he was a senator, gambling was not illegal in the United States. So the Kefauver Committee went after the gambling interests. They couldn't close them down. And the public, believe it or not, unlike the movies where it's always a gang comes in and takes over and pushes them around, there was not one case in America where an illegal casino was not approved by the public. It wasn't made legal because they put people to work in high-paying jobs. They used the farm and ranch produce from the local area for their fine restaurants and showrooms. And So these were very popular, but what the Kefauver Committee did, it exposed all the payoffs to the police, prosecutors, judges, and the public was incensed. So reform movements between late 49 and early 1951 closed down every illegal casino in America except for Hot Springs, Arkansas. And while it took away all of these guys' income, what it made was all the people that used to gamble had no place to go. And that's what set off the Las Vegas tourism. That's why they came here in the 20-year period from Siegel opening the Flamingo in 46 to the opening of Caesar's Palace in 66. 80% of the casinos on the Strip were built by the gangsters that were the biggest in Prohibition and were all dear friends of Siegel's. And they also built in Havana until that was closed down.
I want to talk to you about Cuba in a second. And they all got the money from Jimmy Hoffa and the Teamsters Pension Fund, didn't they?
That came later. Believe it or not, that was the biggest problem they had, was getting money, because it was considered a tainted business because who was running it. Teamsters came in the 1950s and became the key key mortgage makers in the 60s.
And for the record, too, Bill, because I knew Hoffa, that investment that he made, though it was easy money for the mob, they made money for the Teamsters Pension Fund.
Well, that was the irony. On the one hand, they paid. The Teamsters were completely corrupt. I'm not talking about the membership. I'm talking about the leadership. And they were on the take. If you wanted the Teamsters loan, you had to pay them off. So it was a very bad system in principle. But because it was a tainted business, the pension fund charged twice the interest rates that banks were. So although they were taking bribes, the pension fund itself, which paid their pensions for the rest of their lives, it did incredibly well. And although a few places went under, other people bought them, the pension fund never lost money on a single casino investment they made.
Bill, the movie Casino that was done at the old Riviera before they demolished it, with Bobby De Niro and Joe Pesci, Sharon Stone, how realistic was that movie about Vegas?
It's fictional, but it was about real events. It captures the era, and that was the Teamsters era. It was at the Stardust Hotel, which it was centered at, and that was owned by the Chicago mob with the pension fund money. It gives the mood of the place, but, you know, it's still fiction. It was based on events that happened, but the events happened very differently from the movie.
In The Godfather, I believe there was a character named Mo Green. Was he playing the part of Mo Dalitz, who was real?
Yes, yes.
That
was who it was supposed to be, was Mo Dalitz. He's a name that virtually nobody knew. He was so low profile, but he... after Siegel went, he was a dear friend of Siegel's. He built Vegas, and he was the only man that was so respected that no matter what the issue, he could bring all the hotel owners together. They always had some people that were outiers and always had conflicts, and he could sit them all down together, and he raised the most money for charities and didn't want anyone to know he was involved. When people needed money, he'd quietly go around and get it.
Didn't he threaten you once?
Yes.
All right, we're going to take a break. I want to talk about that when we come back in a moment, Bill. Bill Friedman with us. We're talking about Las Vegas. Bill's website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And just an incredible individual. And we will take calls with Bill next hour here on Coast to Coast AM. By the way, we just made another milestone with our YouTube channel. Over 400,000 subscribers. It's free. Jump on board. Go to Coast to Coast AM Official when you put it in the YouTube search bar, okay? You go to YouTube.com, put in Coast to Coast AM Official, subscribe to our channel for free. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We're with casino expert Bill Friedman, and Bill is an author as well. One of his books, 30 Illegal Years to the Strip. So we were talking about Mo Dalitz. He was in the mob, though, wasn't he?
There was three groups of prohibition gangsters that it was the weirdest situation in crime in history. All of the small street gangs went into the prohibition business in their areas. But there was three groups, and they were really gamblers. The only crimes they ever committed was illegal casinos after Prohibition ended, and the Prohibition itself. And the reason they became gamblers, and the reason why I so loved the guys that had come out of this in Vegas, was organized crime is after your money any way they can get it.
That's right.
A gambler wants to get your money without physically harming you.
That's so true.
And these guys, and I never figured out how they got the financing, they all came from lower-income backgrounds, the three gangs. Two of them were in Manhattan, which had over half the wealth of America, and Mo Dalitz and his four partners were in the Midwest. And they brought in all the finest liquor, legal liquor, from all over the world. The two Manhattan groups brought it in with freighters and high-speed boats. Dalitz brought it in from Canada, from Joe Kennedy, delivered it to the shore legally, the father of President John Kennedy.
Right.
And Dalitz and his high-speed boats, and although they were truly high-speed boats, they captured a couple of his boats, and they held 20,000 cases of fine liquor. You know, you're not talking about tiny little speed boats. These were huge, fast boats. Well, these three groups, they violated all the principles that we think of organized crime and the mafia. Their whole thing is violence, vengeance, and monopoly. And all of these guys just literally preached against it, totally opposed it. They didn't think violence was needed because the market was so huge, there was enough for everybody. They really roared against vengeance. They said, anybody you kill has brothers.
That's
right.
And
all you've done is increase the enemies, not reduce them. And monopoly, they said there's enough for everybody. After Prohibition, when gambling, illegal casinos became big, separately, Ben Siegel and Meyer Lansky went across America to various large cities. They bribed the police, they bribed the prosecutors, they bribed the judges for one crime, casinos. And instead of, they had a monopoly and they could have told the police, keep everybody else out without any violence on their part.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as they got the go-ahead, they called all the major gangs in America and said, we're open, come join us. They were smart enough to have figured out that a casino all by itself will not be near as profitable as it will be if there's a bunch of them together.
Interesting. Now, why did Mo Dalitz want you out of Vegas?
Well, he was one of these big three, and when he came to Vegas, he arrived in 1950, and he opened the Desert Inn, which was the greatest high-rolling, first high-rolling casino on the Strip. Then in 58, he opened the Stardust. There was no hotel in town over 300 rooms, very few in the world, and it was 1,000 rooms, biggest hotel, biggest casino, and in fact, very good hotelmen I knew told me they didn't know how he was going to check everyone in and out because it was before computers. Well, he built this empire, and I knew that this was the key man in the industry, brilliant on casino operations, plus he was the most connected man in the in organized crime. Everybody I went to interview, when I started my interviewing, what was interesting is, on the one hand, the prohibition background people were the tightest-lipped I've ever met. They never talked about themselves at all. The rationale being they didn't want to tip off when they were going out to sea to get a new load, when they were going to their warehouses, where they were. They didn't talk at all. I hit them at a time when they were selling out. They were all born around the beginning of the century. And I started my research in 1967, and that's when they were selling. And for the first time, corporations were coming in, and it was becoming legitimate.
Howard Hughes was coming in, too, wasn't he?
Exactly. Then so this transition was occurring, and these people had been berated in the press their whole lives, and they wanted to leave the truth for their children. And so they went from the most silent people to, we're ready to tell our stories. If I had hit them any other time, there's no clever way I could have gotten them to talk. They wanted to talk. And sometimes they'd say bad things about themselves, and whenever it was something I couldn't have discovered through research, I'd say, now, I couldn't get this without you. You don't look good. If you want to make this off the record, I will not write it. And every time they said to me, no, you can write the bad stuff.
Wow.
But write it all. Tell the truth, the whole truth.
Don't hold back.
That's it. So anyway, Dalitz was a key figure. I needed him. And all these other people were cooperating, and I couldn't get to him for a year. Every time I talked to someone that knew him well, I'd say, put in my word for me, etc. Got nowhere. Finally, someone, he lived on the ninth floor, the top floor of the Stardust. It had long early hotel type where they were two-story long distances that you walked to the casino. And the nine-story building, he had the top floor. And I had it. And I planned it very carefully because I knew I was getting one shot. I couldn't call during the week because he wouldn't be in. I wasn't going to disturb him in the evening. So I called him at 10:15 on a Sunday, figuring hopefully he's awake and hopefully he hasn't left. And I pitched him. And so he said, I'll meet you at 8:30 in my office tomorrow morning. That was a Monday, and then he said to me, real angry, he says, now can I go back and watch the football game? And I knew that I had really irritated him.
You're lucky they didn't ax you, or ace you, or whatever they call it.
Well, at 8:30, I show up in the office, and it was a long, narrow lobby. And there was a secretary at the far end, and I told her where I was, and I went and sat there, and there's three businessmen waiting to see various people.
On a Sunday?
No, this was Monday morning.
This Monday morning. Okay.
So there was a man sitting there, a fourth man, and he kept staring at me and staring at me, and I'd never seen a picture of Dalitz. I had no idea who it was. And finally he came over, and to step back a second, Siegel was given this ridiculous temper by the authors of the time because they knew nothing about him. In his whole life, he was the number one prohibitionist in America, the number one in Manhattan, and the New York Times only wrote about him 13 times because he was so low profile. And so they made up, because of his childhood nickname Bugsy, they made up a thing that he had this wild temper. Now, it was unusual in that it went up very fast and down very fast, but it was, I cannot believe that there's any listener that hasn't seen worse in their life.
Why, on the other hand,
had a temper like I could not believe, and all of his key executives later told me when I said it was like nothing I've ever seen, they said, you didn't see him at his worst. It came from his gut. It built up. He didn't swear. He didn't stutter. He just spoke. And he tore into me for 10 minutes.
Wow.
And everything in me, I'm not talking about a head trip now, everything in me said, you open your mouth, you're dead. I just stared at him as he let go.
Yes, sir, right?
And he said, if you keep up what you're doing, you're going to find out things that are going to put me in prison.
Whoa.
And he said, you are going to stop your research, and you are going to leave this town.
And did you?
No. Well, then he said, you go back to your apartment, and I'm going to send someone over there to settle this. And people today are working in their homes. I'm not exaggerating. Nobody worked from their home then. Whoever was coming was there.
Well, how did they settle this?
Him there. I went back to my apartment, and I had a dear friend gone to college with in Reno that was sleeping on my couch. Well, he got an apartment because he got a job in Vegas, and I told him, I think they're sending someone to kill me.
Good thought.
I've never heard of doing a business negotiation in someone's apartment, and he said, I think you're right. And I hadn't realized it, but in the 2 minutes I was talking, he packed everything up. He said, what are you doing? He says, I'm leaving. And he was gone. He says, still the funniest story he's ever told. Well, I thought they were going to send someone over, and I sat there from 9 o'clock at that morning until 11 p.m. that night waiting for a knock at the door. I didn't turn on the TV. I didn't turn on the radio. And I was so afraid that I was about to get killed that I just stared at the wall. And for all those hours, I heard Peggy Lee singing, Is This All There Is? And I thought I was dead. So that night, I went out and ate. Finally, I hadn't eaten the whole day.
The Last Supper, right?
Yeah. And I thought at that point I knew no one was coming. But I also knew I was finished with him, that we were going nowhere. And then on Thursday, after, you know, okay, I can't get to this, his administrative assistant called me up, who was a former police chief of Las Vegas, and said, I want to talk to you. Well, I came in, and he set up a lunch with Mo. And we had lunch together, and we had a very nice discussion. Then we had a second luncheon, and the oddest behavior I've ever seen in a human being, I wasn't talking about anything that was upsetting, but he kept getting more and more agitated till he finally said, I can't do this. I can't talk. I don't talk about myself. I don't talk about other people. He said, this is over. I said, so,
And you're just sitting there chatting, right?
Yeah. Yes. Like, you know, a very normal chat, but he was upset just because this was a man who never talked. This is one of the reasons everybody trusted him. And so I said to him, I said, this town's been very good to you, and you've been very good to this town. But if you don't give me your history, no one's ever going to know any of this. And he said, I am going to tell all my people, they can talk to you, And no matter what the consequences are, there'll be no repercussions, but you ain't going to talk to me again. And he said, but there's one person that knows everything about me, and that was the convention coordinator. Not coordinator, because they work in-house, a convention salesman.
Mm-hmm.
So now I go see all of his people. They were very open. I started off with, he has a temper like I've never seen, and you know, they were very open. They said, oh, you haven't seen him at his worst. So all these people work and contribute to me, but a few years into it, I developed the convention salesman, had no children, and we developed a very close relationship, father-son relationship, even though I had a very good relationship with my father. I had this tight thing with him.
Yeah.
But I never understood, how does he know everything about a man who never talks? And finally, I'd been around long enough that they knew I was okay, and he told me the facts of the case. He said, Mo was terrified of what you'd find out. And he said, so you thought all of us liked you. He said, Mo is my favorite person in the world. I hated you. He said, we all acted like your uncle. We were all under orders from him. Give the kid anything he wants. But when he's done interviewing you, ask him who he's been talking to. Ask him what kinds of things he's been talking about. The moment he starts learning what we don't want, I want to be notified.
Wow.
And then he told me the story, and I never could have figured it out. There was all kinds of overworld activities with lawsuits and different things that all prove what he was telling me was true. They tied together, but I never could have tied them together without the context. And he finished with no threat, no nothing, just said to me, but you won't ever write about this until Mo has retired from the business.
Interesting.
No threat, no nothing, just, but they knew me well enough that that was the way it was. And this incredible story he was afraid of, I never could have put together, and they gave it to me.
Did they ever dump people in the desert, Bill?
No. Well, let me put it this way. This group I...
Hold on for a second, Bill. We're at the top of the hour. We'll come back. We'll pick that up. I want to talk to you about the Rat Pack to see if you ever saw Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., and Dean Martin together. And then, of course, why did they kill Bugsy Siegel? And we'll take calls next on Coast to Coast AM.